This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Hi, and welcome to all of you, and thanks very much for the organizers of the GRIT series for inviting me. And you're all probably wondering what on earth gut microbes have to do with sustainability. And I'm going to use the next 20 to 25 minutes or so to tell you how I think those things are connected and identify some opportunities for research and development that can help get us to a more sustainable world. So first and foremost, let's start off by our motivation. What do I mean? What are our starting products? Well, I'm an engineer, and so we start with feedstocks, something to begin a catalytic chemical conversion process to make something that's value-added, something more valuable than what we started with. And so you can imagine that there's a lot of probably puzzling looks at looking at biomass and garbage, right? So how can we possibly manage to take these things that we toss away or we burn and make chemicals and fuels and maybe even pharmaceuticals out of them? So let me tell you what's hiding in this garbage, right? So there's two flavors here. So one is non-food plant materials. So these are the things that we don't eat. They're not the fruits and the vegetables or corn and things like that. They are the corn stalks and corn stover and grasses that grow in the Great Plains. They have some intrinsic value in there. If we could harness and figure out how to convert them to something else, then they would be quite valuable. And so I'm going to throw up some terms here that I'm going to bring up through the rest of the talk. So cellulose is the primary polymer in the non-food part of plants. There's a lot of value there I'll talk about in a second. There's also hemicellulose, which is a slightly different flavor of cellulose, so made up of different components. And then lignin, which is something that gives plants intrinsic structure and keeps microbes from eating them. And there's also food scraps and co-mingled waste. So you can think of things that you might compost when maybe you're done with dinner and you toss things in your garbage can or you compost. You have things there that are food, right? They have simple sugars there. They have pectin, right? You think of orange peels, things like that. Things otherwise that we referred to as fiber, right? And so these starting sources are really where we're starting our motivation from. So how can we possibly turn this into a biofuel or chemical, right? And so let me illustrate for you how we can do this. So just starting with one of these polymers in the non-food part of plants. So this is called cellulose. Many of you have probably heard of it, and it's a big polymer. It's a three-dimensional structure that if you can break it down into something simpler, we can work with it. How do we do that? Well, in industry, and how we're thinking of it, is to gain access to that cellulose and then to tease it apart into workable units. We do that with the action of some of our biological catalysts that are out in the world. These are called enzymes. What enzymes do is they take a polymer like this and they chew it apart into the simple subunits. And what we're left with is something that we're all probably pretty familiar with, sugar. Right? So if you look at one of these little subunits in cellulose and you pull it apart, you end up with things that look like table sugar or like glucose, right? And this is important because this is a base unit that we can start to feed to people, to microbes, and we can convert it to lots of other things that have added value. And so take, for example, we'll feed it to a microbe, so baker's yeast, brewer's yeast, or bacteria. And these guys are fantastic workhorses because they will gobble up all that sugar and turn it into something that could be a fuel or a chemical. And in doing that, we can realize this goal of making fuels, chemicals, and even pharmaceuticals, basically anything that we can find in a single-cell microbe in the world to make, or anything that we can engineer a microbe to make. So long story short, we go from something that's waste material, we clip up the bonds using enzymes into sugar, and that sugar becomes a building block to make something more valuable. So that sounds great. What I'm going to tell you about are how we can attack this idea of finding new enzymes to try and improve this overall process. And so why is this challenging? Because what I just showed you seems like it should work pretty well, right? And there's been people for the past several decades looking at ways to improve that process, but here's the reason why it's difficult. So the main problem is due to the structure of plant material in general. So if we're looking at the non-food part of plants, we look at cellulose that I just showed you that can be turned into sugar, but this is trapped in a matrix of other things that are surrounding it. It's difficult to gain access to that cellulose. There's also some of the other biopolymers that are localized in different places in the plant. We want to get at those with enzymes, but get at them efficiently. But here's the reason why it's tough. So if we want to just target the cellulose, we need special enzymes, so a flavor of these enzymes called cellulases that are particularly engineered. We need three or more of them to turn cellulose into sugar. So that's at least three enzymes. If we want to try and take apart hemicellulose, we need at least three other different types of enzymes, and these are referred to as hemicellulases. So now, if we're counting, we're up to six different types of enzymes that we need, and probably the biggest problem to turning this into something economically viable is lignin. You may have never heard of lignin before, but it's the main component of plants that keep other enzymes and other microbes from chewing it up. So if you've ever gone down a wooded path and you see an overturned tree, and it's that tree stump looks like it's been there for years, chances are good that it has been, largely because that plant has lignin in it. And these chemical compounds are aromatic, which means that they're generally harmful to other microbes that are out in the world, so they don't get degraded. And they also inactivate these types of enzymes that we would use to take these polymers down into sugar that we so desperately want. And so the take-home message here is that this is a mess, right? But nature is really, really smart in organizing things this way, because this is obviously good for the plant. It keeps the plant together, but it makes it really tough for engineers to take apart the plant. So what can we do? Well, if you think about places out in the world that are really, really good already at taking apart non-food parts of plant biomass down into sugar, you might think of this cow, right? So this cow grows big and strong just by grazing, right? If we tried to eat grass in the way that the cow does, we would have huge indigestion problems, right? But this cow doesn't have that problem. Why, right? What can we learn from how this cow has thrived? And if we peer inside of a cow or a horse or a zebra or a giraffe, any large herbivore, what we'll find is that the microbes in their gut have co-evolved with them through time to become really, really good at making the enzymes that we need to chew up that crude biomass to sugars. And that animal gets some of the sugars and grows big and strong. And then in turn, the microbes get some of that sugar, and they can coexist, and it's a symbiotic relationship, right? And the types of microorganisms and these gut microbes that I'm talking about are anaerobes. So specifically, the type of microbes that thrive where oxygen isn't, right? So these are not microbes that you're going to find out in the world. They're not on our skin, but they are in our gut. They're in the gut of these large herbivores, and they're in soil, and they're in compost, right? And anaerobes are really cool, but because they thrive without oxygen around, they're really difficult to study. So what can we learn from them? So many of you have probably heard the buzz about the gut microbiome, the human gut microbiome, for instance, and we're still learning today, and probably for decades, how the microbes in our gut play a key role in immunity, in nutrition, and in several other functions, maybe even brain function, that we're still uncovering, right? But the idea here is that each microbe is there for a reason. So some might be doing one thing while others are regulating that first population. But when you break it down, every microbe in the gut has a job. It has a role. It has a reason for being there. And part of the reason why we're just learning a lot about these gut microbes now is because we finally have the biotechnology approaches to look at them. So we can sequence genomes now really fast and really cheaply, and we can get a really deep view of what's going on, even in these complicated gut systems. But the challenge remains. So nature's learned how to do this with gut microbes and herbivores. So how can we as engineers and scientists build off of what nature's already done to try and develop new solutions to turn non-food or commingled waste into scalable bioprocesses to make fuels and chemicals? And so what I'm going to tell you about today are a couple of short stories inspired by the work that my research group does here at UCSB. And first is I'm going to tell you about how we've pioneered new approaches to actually isolate gut microbes from out in the world, and this is kind of fun. And in addition, how we're using some new techniques in genomic sequencing and high-powered technology to really find new enzymes that have been hiding in nature this entire time. And then finally, how we could engineer microbes that could turn those sugars into something valuable, be it a fuel, a chemical, or a pharmaceutical. And what that might look like is this, right? So this is our end goal, where we would have plant material, and this might be cellulose, and so this microorganism will produce enzymes that chew up that cellulose into sugar, and then it's going to use some of that sugar to make things like butanol, ethanol, or really anything that we can program this microorganism to make. Okay, so getting right into things, many of you, I'm sure, live in Santa Barbara or have been visiting for a little bit. You may not know that we have a fantastic zoo, and the zoo is a terrific partner in our research endeavors by providing samples for us, or they say that their tenants are continuously producing samples, and I'll show you what that means in a minute, but here's my research group collecting samples. And so what does that look like? It's exactly what you think it is. We actually collect the gut microbes as they pass through the animal, so it doesn't hurt the animal for us to get them. We just come by in an opportune moment. So here's a collaborator, Mike Theodoru, and one of my students, Sean Gilmore, who's there sampling a fresh sample. And I love this picture because it's a lot of my group and some collaborators who are staring into the collection of elephant dung at the Santa Barbara Zoo. Fortunately for our research, we don't need this much. What we do need is just a really small amount. So what are we looking for as we're searching through these herbivore fecal pellets, right? What types of microbes are we after? And so this is a little bit of a biology lesson, but we're looking for gut microbes, specifically anaerobic gut fungi. You've probably never heard of these organisms ever before, mostly because very few people study them, and they weren't even recognized as being fungi until a couple of decades ago. And so this is the tree of life, where things that are for fungi and things that are down closer to the base here are older. So these were some of the first microorganisms on the Earth. Things that are up here are newer from an evolution standpoint. And so the anaerobic fungi are very, very old. They're some of the most primitive microorganisms on the Earth, and they were thought to have evolved when the Earth actually didn't have oxygen on it. And so there's 8 different genera, or we could call it flavors, of the anaerobic fungi. Most of them were discovered in Wales, and so therefore have very unfortunate Welsh names that I'm not even going to try and pronounce for you, like this one. But I'm going to tell you about a few of them throughout the rest of the talk. And this is how they grow. So this is super cool, right? It almost looks like a parasite. You have sort of a zoospore phase of the fungus that literally swims around until it finds a place to land, so a piece of cellulose, for instance. And then it starts to grow into that piece of biomass, and that root network spits out enzymes that really weaken the biomass and then release sugar. And ultimately, some of the microbes capture that sugar, and some of it's released to the greater microbial community. But this grows and grows until this mature fungus releases a pack of spores, and then the whole cycle repeats. Part of the reason why people haven't studied these fungi is not only because they're difficult to study, but also because they haven't really been able to be controlled. So we haven't had genetic engineering tools and very few characterized genes, right? So we don't really know what the enzymes are that we're looking for. And so how do we actually isolate these fungi? So coming back to the zoo samples, so these are high-resolution images of animal poop. That's exactly what it is. And we take each of these samples, we grind them up, and we use really old-school microbiology techniques to kind of coax the biomass-eating microbes out of that sample. And then they come alive on the edges of what's called this roll tube, where each one of these spots is an isolated microbe. And then people in my lab will actually pick one of these guys off the side, grow it up, and then we see what we have. So this is a snapshot of some of the novel microbes that have never before been discovered from the zoo animals. And you can see I'll highlight a few for you. So this one is Pyramyces finis, so it grows into biomass, and it has a head structure here. And then there's also, this is actually named after a horse who's called Huckleberry Finn. And these two are from the Neocalamastix family. This one we named after California. And this Aneuromyces isolate we named after the gray whale that migrates through the Santa Barbara Channel. You can probably see why. Right? And so this is cool. We can isolate microbes, but what do the microbes do for us? And so what we do is we actually screen the microbes in the lab by challenging them with crude biomass waste. So we basically challenge them, and then we watch them grow. The fungi burrow into that sawdust-looking stuff. This is reed canary grass. And then they produce gases. And that fermentation gas gets trapped there. And then we can actually leverage that to track how they grow. So here you see a growth curve that gives you some idea of how the fungi actually respond to different food sources. Some of these you might recognize, so simple sugars like glucose and fructose and xylose. Other things look like paper, right? So filter paper is a pretty good model for cellulose. And then also bioenergy crops like reed canary grass or switchgrass, and they grow very well on either, right? And so each one of the isolates that we get from the zoo animals is capable of growing on these different food sources and to various different extents. And so you've probably figured out that my lab is probably a little young, so this is actually my fifth year at UCSB, and this is a lot of fun to start up this research, but one thing I didn't know is how one is supposed to talk to reporters. And so for you young scientists, always ask to proof an article. So we had the LA Times be very interested in some of the work that we're doing, and so I'll let you guys read this first sentence. But always ask to proof an article. But I think it shows that, you know, everybody is really interested in sustainability, especially a little non-traditional approaches to achieving sustainability, and it's nice to have at least one of my students' micrographs in the LA Times. Okay, so that's fun. So how do we actually figure out what the enzymes are? Because that's what we're after, right? We want to be able to take these non-food sources of plant biomass and take them down into sugar. We need powerful enzymes to do that. Many of you have probably heard of enzymes before, and if not, enzymes are protein, which means that they are encoded for in genes that are in DNA. So we have DNA, microbes have DNA, all life forms have DNA, right? And what happens is when the gene to make that enzyme is activated, it becomes a transcript or an RNA molecule. And so what we wanted to do, because all of our isolates had never before been characterized, was to really sample this RNA as kind of a currency of enzyme production. And what we're looking to do is we take these isolates and we challenge them in different ways. So we know that they will grow on different food sources, and they're going to tune the genes that they're firing in order to match that challenge. And our hypothesis, it's very important to have a hypothesis when you're doing any sort of research, was very simple. Microbes are greedy. In other words, what that means is that they're not going to work harder than they need to survive. right? It's a pretty central tenet of a lot of different situations. And so, in other words, what does that mean? Fungi, like the ones that I showed you, are probably only going to make the enzymes that they need when they have to, right? So in other words, if we grow them on plant material with nothing else, they have to make enzymes or they're going to die, right? But if you give them something that's easier to eat, like glucose, there's absolutely no reason to make those enzymes. So by comparing what changes under those two conditions, we can really get a sense from completely novel strains what enzymes are the most important. And to do that, we do a lot of bioinformatics, and I'm not going to tell you a lot about this. This is crude data, just giving you a sense for we have to actually assemble all of these genes from scratch. We assembled 27,000 genes from one of these anaerobic fungi, and then we sort through the genes, and we ask ourselves, using computational algorithms, does this look like a cellulase? Does this look like a hemicellulase? Does this look like something else? And then we can bin what we sort through. And using that type of technology, we can only really ascribe some sort of function to about one-third of what we find. So a lot of what we find, in fact, the majority, is completely new sequences that we've never seen before. But if we take a step back and look again at that fungal tree of life, and these are the anaerobic fungi, what this is showing is that they have the single most expansive repertoire of enzymes that anybody's ever characterized before out in nature. So in other words, they have this arsenal of cellulases, hemicellulases, and things that chew up even pectin that have been hiding in nature for a long, long time. And so we're really encouraged that some of these enzymes can translate directly into industry. And we're really after novel enzymes, so things that had never before been seen. And it's kind of difficult to hunt for that, but we can come back to our hypothesis that microbes are greedy, and we can start to see what we find. So one thing that we have used genomic sequencing to do is to look at how microbes respond when we kind of raise the bar of their food source. So the simplest food source that we have them eat is glucose. And then as we step from left to right here, the food source becomes more woody, more difficult to eat, right? And so as you see, a lot of these families of enzymes that we know start to fire. So the organism is responding to its environment. And we've worked with some collaborators to actually use this as kind of a way to decipher how new enzymes might be regulated. So in other words, what we do is we use these guys kind of as queries to uncover co-regulated enzymes that we don't already know. We're screening these completely novel enzymes with the National Renewable Energy Lab and Argonne National Lab, and we think there's a lot of potential here. So looking at how these fungi grow, which is kind of cool, we can use microscopy, which is exciting. Every time you look at cells under a microscope, you find this world of complexity. And this is what the anaerobic fungi look like. And we can stain them, and we can stain their membranes, we can stain their nuclear material. We can get tremendous insight. And I thought it would be neat to share some new data with you guys, which is looking at helium ion microscopy. So here you can see kind of super resolution, how the fungi are growing in to cellulosic biomass. So how you can interpret this is kind of left to right here in both cases, you're zooming in on a fungal invaded piece of biomass. So here you can see those rhizoids, those little root networks kind of burrowing in, and you see that they're splaying out that biomass and leaving behind some netting material that we still don't know what this is. We just got this result in this last week, but we're really excited that it might be lignin or it might be protein or it might be a mixture of those two. In addition, we can also see the fungi really close up. So this is one of these head structures, and you can see potentially even proteins dotting the sides of the structures, which is really cool. And so lastly, I just want to wrap up and tell you how we're translating some of this technology. So I told you that we can go to visit the zoo here in Santa Barbara and find novel microbes that have valuable enzymes, right? So many enzymes that we can use for biotech, but how do we actually translate those findings? So one thing that we could do is to take the enzymes and actually just put them in a microbe right now, right? And then we can accomplish that goal that I told you about in the beginning, where we actually make the microbe make the enzyme, and then the enzyme releases sugar. The microbe takes some of that sugar and then releases it, and then also converts the sugar to a fuel or to a product of whatever we want it to do. We can also develop new genetic engineering strategies to actually manipulate the anaerobic fungi directly. And that would be really exciting, because then we can use, we don't have to teach these guys how to make enzymes. They already know how to do it well. Maybe we could, all we need to do is teach them how to make products. But something else that we could do is to actually create partnerships with microbes and combine them in natural and synthetic co-culture for production purposes. And so how we might do this is by dividing difficult jobs over microbial partners. And this is how nature does things in general, right? You don't want to ask a microbe to do so much. You want to kind of ask its friends to help. And so in the herbivores that we talked about, fungi and bacteria degrade biomass, but there's also methanogens and protists that help kind of divide the workload and get rid of the products that inhibit those enzymes that are, or inhibit the microbes that are producing enzymes. But we don't really understand how nutrients flow in that system and what the tipping point really is and the balancing point. But we're encouraged in finding out that when we take samples from these zoo animals, that actually having microbial partnerships really accelerates the biomass degradation behavior that we see in these unusual microbes. So here you can see cellulose, which filter paper, being degraded by fungi. But fungi now, with their resident methanogens, actually really crumple up that paper very, very fast. And so we're excited to figure out why this is happening and to capitalize on that type of partnership to translate for bioprocessing and biotechnology. And lastly, what I'll tell you about is that we're trying to learn the rules that nature uses to pair microbes together so that we can replicate that in the lab for scalable bioprocessing. And again, this kind of divide and conquer approach to breaking down non-food waste material into sugar, but then having a symbiotic relationship microbe convert that into something else. And this can also be leveraged for finding what's called natural products. So most antibiotics are actually produced as a result of microbe-to-microbe warfare. So antibiotics are actually nature's way of keeping microbes at bay. And so by challenging microbes in a lab setting, you can actually awaken some of those natural products, those antibiotics and other things, to accelerate drug discovery. And so with that, I hope that some of the takeaway messages from this talk have been that anaerobes are pretty cool. They're not only worthy of study, but they can give us a lot of novel enzymes to really help us chew up biomass into fermentable sugars, and that there's a lot of potential here for exploring these unusual anaerobic consortia for applications not limited to sustainability, but maybe even bridging into finding new products from nature. And with that, I'll thank my group and all the people who actually did the work. They're all pictured here, and funding and support. And lastly, I'll leave you with a picture that I was fortunate to take at the White House about a month or so ago. So as mentioned, I was an awardee of the Presidential Early Career Award for Scientists and Engineers, and we all got to meet President Obama, who's actually here. You can probably see him and see if you can find me. Hint, I'm over here. And with that, I'd like to thank you all for your kind attention. I'm happy to take questions.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.